For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website. Well, good evening. I just start. I appreciate the chance to do a Dharma talk. When I'm asked to do a Dharma talk, it forces me to think about my questions so that I can then study the things I want to study. And a question of mine that comes up every once in a while is, what am I doing here? I kind of know what I'm doing here, but when recently someone was inquiring about Buddhist practice, I found myself not able to articulate easily exactly what happens or why I was suggesting they try it. And so then I had to explore. I also think sometimes about people who are coming for the first time here who are just curious. But the crowd tonight has been here and you know what this is about. But the whole issue of the self and what is the self and what is the goal about the self is something that comes up for me and that I try to grapple with from time to time. And so that's what I want to talk about tonight. First I'm going to review some readings about the self. And I pulled these from the textbook that you suggested years ago by Snelling. And so going to a textbook definition of the goal around this practice, Buddhist practice in general, not just Soto Zen, around the self. And then I want to explore some of my own ideas some things that help me step out of my own subjectivity a little bit. And then I want to refer to the book Not Always So by Shunryu Suzuki, the chapter Wherever I Go, I Meet Myself. And so so in the Buddhist handbook, it's discussed that Buddha's way points to a development that leads beyond I, to a larger horizons. It unlocks the door of individuality and offers freedom, nirvana. He notes that basic Buddhist teachings are our own and the world's are, that our own and the world's ills derive from the fact that our perception of the world is distorted. We seek permanence and security where they are not available. We focus on I as central reference point, but egocentric view leads to selfishness. The antidote, he describes as the Buddhist antidote, is to watch and understand how these problems arise in the first place. Then proceed, try to cure them by morality, meditation, wisdom. Then we can see things as they really are. A complete reorientation takes place. The mind arrives at everything that arises also passes away and is not the self. So, some of my own thoughts things that have helped me loosen up a little bit from my being completely in my own life and not recognizing it sometimes. Meaning, I can be within my own you know, you're in your goal-directed life, you're getting things done, you're thinking short-term, long-term, and you sometimes forget that how much this is just your life, one little life in the midst of millions. And so things that help me step out of that a little bit or imagine a different way. And it's things in literature and the arts for me. And so there's a film that I especially like called Wings of Desire. Have any of you seen it? David, you have, and Tygan?
No. Mm-hmm.
It is. I recommend it. So it's 1987. Wim Wenders did it in Berlin, and it's after the end of the war, but before the German wall, the Berlin Wall has been taken down. And it's these two angels. You begin with these two angels. It's all black and white, and they're sitting on top of these tall buildings, and they're looking down on people. And they, as they scan people, they can stop and they can hear their inner thoughts. And so the movie is these angels who are dressed in long trench coats going above the city and zeroing in, and you see faces and then you hear thoughts. And it can just be musings at times, like something about their spouse or something about their... where they came from or what they hope for, or sometimes it's abstract. Sometimes it's an old man remembering what was like before the war. Sometimes it's a whole variety of things. And so it creates this impact of putting it in context. And they also at one point talk about having witnessed the changes in humans since the beginning of humankind. So the idea that these angels have been up there observing since the beginning of humans and remembering the first war. And so whenever I watch this film, and I've watched it a few times, it somehow... makes me realize how much we're part of like a huge, large flow of things. And that, and there is a universality that comes through in terms of thinking about people in that circumstance. Of course they'd be thinking those thoughts. But also some of the feelings of isolation that people have. Sometimes the longing. And so I don't know exactly why that film has the impact on me, but it helps me loosen up and dislodge a little bit from being so stuck in my own identity. Helps in getting beyond a sense of myself as the center of the universe, even though... we only have our own lives to observe the universe, but things like that help you begin to realize everybody, you know, that there's a lot of different observation points here. Clear how similar we are and how connected while still stuck in our own worlds. And so it reminds me sometimes of when I was a kid, I used to stand over an anthill and just stare at the ants for a long time and watch them. These angels were kind of doing that, and it makes you realize. And with the ants, after a minute, you can't tell which is which. You can't follow. They become interchangeable. And so that gives a different perspective. Then, in another way, historical novels give you a different vantage point. I like historical novels, and I like them because especially when they give you the culture and the history and the impact on the way the characters were thinking and acting. And so a book I recently reread, maybe the third time, I don't know how many times, is Age of Innocence by Edith Wharton. And it's about the life of the social elite of New York City in 1870s. And so it begins by you're following this sort of a love story, and then by the end of it you realize it's much more than that. It is a story about the social norms in the upper social classes at that time, which they kind of brought over from England. Some of it reminds me of the Edwardian period. Their lives were so ruled by social strictures, who you should be seen with and in what places, as well as their personal lives, you know, like how you should act with your spouse, how you sit at dinner, who sits where. But I guess it kind of makes clear by the end of the book that they seem kind of trapped in this very restricted way of viewing the world. And so it makes it clear, you know, how we all are. You know, we're all in a cultural tradition, you know. And, you know, even in this Sangha, we have our own ideas and cultural traditions. And so we become, you know, almost limited by that. And I think it's important to be able to see that, because if we can see that, then we can imagine how other people who are raised in a totally different culture or in a different point in time might have seen or now see the world very differently from us, which is another thing that helps me to get pulled out of myself. And so and I think the idea of historical perspective does that in general. I think historians maybe have sometimes I wonder if they have a more objective view, if they can get outside of their cultural position easier because of the historical perspective. Now I want to refer a little bit to the book by Shunryu Suzuki, Not Always So, which is a favorite. And he points out that our culture is focused on self-improvement. And then he says in his pithy way, improvement is based on comparative value, which is also the basis of our economy and something else which I left out. Perhaps most of you sit to improve your zazen, but Buddhists do not hold so strongly to the idea of improvement. He states that when you're struck by something, that is the real you. He gives the example of being struck by observing someone's practice and thinking, she is doing very well. That she is neither she nor you. She is something more than that. As long as you are trying to improve yourself, you have a core idea of self, which is wrong practice. When you empty your mind, when you give up everything and just practice zazen with an open mind, then whatever you see, you meet yourself. And then the other side of our practice is that we think and we act. We do not try to be like a stone. Everyday life is our practice. Instead of being enslaved by the thinking mind or the imagination or emotional activity, we just think in its true sense. Thinking comes to us from our true self, which includes everything. Before we think about it, trees, birds, and everything are thinking. And when they think, they groan or they sing. That is their thinking. There is no need for us to think more than that. If we see things as it is, thinking is already there. This kind of pure thinking is the thinking we have in our practice, so we always have freedom from ourselves too. We can see things as it is, and at the same time we can think about things. Because we do not cling to any particular standard for thinking, for us there is no true way and no false way. Thank you very much. And so, it's kind of like, do you get it? So I also think nature is the third way. In that, the more you read about nature or immerse in it, you realize the interconnection and the interdependence, and that you see a bird and you know they need their energy to get food and build a nest and mate and have babies and go through their life cycle, and they don't have time to think about I. And that there's an interconnection between all of that, and that it seems there's a certain contentment too. And so, I've had a lot of different thoughts about this, but I think I'll throw it open to discussion and just see what it stirs up for other people. But I do like the idea of when you see somebody else's practice and you say, that's a good practice, that it's like he says it's your practice as well as their practice. It's like because you're having an aha moment, you're having a sense of that's genuine or that's practice. Anyway, any thoughts?
Thank you for these reflections on self and wider self and limitations of our usual self idea. So, yeah, comments, responses from selves or not selves.
Yes, Alex. Maybe you go down. This question of self and larger self reminds me of this sort of practice that I do sometimes where at a certain point, the thought just occurred to me that, my internal monologue uses this word "I" to refer to myself, but so does everyone else's. Everyone's an I. Everyone has their own I. And so sometimes I'll do this thing when I'm walking and just seeing people on the street. You know, I'll narrate what they're doing in the first person. Like, oh, there I go. I go over there. Like, oh, look, I'm crossing the street. And it's a very, it gets to a kind of weird place very quickly, but it's, I think, an interesting thing.
I like that.
Me, we'll try that.
Thanks, Jenny. I knew there was something off that you were here this Monday evening.
I'd like to come more often. I'm going to try to, but it's hard to get here.
Well, thank you so much for your talk. It's often said that we are, simply because we are of this world, or simply because we are in this world, is not required that we are of it. And the implication of that as well is might be that the acquiring and pursuit of knowledge or self-understanding is only not available to us other than the form of a choice. And as a choice, it's necessarily an ethical decision. And I think that it brings back the burden of knowing the self, strictly upon our own, and that we cannot require a model of reconciliation with the world to arrive at. And I think that this practice, the Buddhist practice, I think that's a foremost recognition more so and maybe more prominently in place than many traditions that we also practice or practice in this country. And so it's one of my appreciations of the Buddhist perspective of spiritual understanding. I think you were pointing to that off and on throughout your talk.
Back up to what you just said about the reconciliation, reconciliation of what again?
Well, so in the observation of the world, we can't acquire knowledge. You can only exercise it with something that's a comparative model. Knowledge only exists, knowledge only available to us as a choice, which makes it ethic, which makes it personal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that in our readings, even tonight, that would point to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's what I think I see. When you look back and see a historical period and you think how people were shaped by living in the norms of that time, you get a glimpse of that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that's also maybe part of what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
And I had a question about what you said, though. What's the part of it that you were seeing as ethical? I didn't quite get how you meant that.
I think conventionally, at least conventionally understood, when we make a choice, we might assume that our choice is supported by our social conditioning or our world or our environment or choices, whatever we call it.
Which kind of choice do you mean, though, in terms of self? Because maybe I got lost. I was interested in what you were saying, but I...
Oh, is it possible that the choice of knowing... The choice of what we do know, or the choice of acting on knowledge. And
the choice.
In other words, is this in the case of a statement by a person, is that the person making a correct statement or an incorrect statement, and making an observation that is reliable or is it unreliable, is it false or is it true? You have to make those choices every day, and sometimes maybe I make them certain. Based on surrounding evidence, then they have to be primary, that is generally your social and social value, versus my decision to evaluate that truth. And my recognition that it is my choice, it's my responsibility to make that evaluation, therefore it is my truth, and therefore it is my ethic. It cannot be something sourced from the outside the world. And I guess part of where it's Black History Month, and a lot of what I'm hearing, you know, the buzzes, the different kinds of experience different communities have within the same physical space, of that physical space.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes to the question of how knowledge is acquired, and how knowledge exists, and where it exists. And you were saying in your talk, Kathy, about how you...
Mm-hmm.
Seek understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm a psychologist, so I am curious about how people change, what helps that as people kind of go on a journey or a search to make choices or identify themselves, establish who they are. You know, I'm just reading Michelle Obama's autobiography right now, and it's wonderful. And it's interesting as she describes what shaped her early life and how she was very goal-directed going through Princeton and law school and knew she needed to make money and be successful. Her parents had gone to lots of sacrifice to provide this educational opportunity, but eventually decided she wanted a more meaningful career and left law to do things that were more community-based. And so thinking about how people are shaped, and her husband kind of helped shape her, but she was all, you know, in that they, when they came together, they were both thinking along those lines in terms of where should change happen and how do we support it. And so, But it was interesting to think about what shaped her, and she was trying to get at that, I think, in the book.
Being a Southside Chicago, and there's a lot of social pressures on that community, probably certainly was in the Southside myself, and I have some appreciation for the conventional framework that's constantly thrown in front of you, that you want to be, that you want to honor and participate.
And being a minority in high school especially, and as well as in college, and having experiences where she had a hard time trusting her own, where, I mean, she kind of felt challenged repeatedly. So to gain self-confidence was a challenge, but she did.
That comes back to what you were talking about history and different cultures, as you were saying, Ed, that if we think about ethics and values, and then what's the perspective of a self, that it shifts, is relative in different cultural, historical contexts. So, you know, there's ethical relativism, and then how do we find so part of our precepts is to find some principles for what might be ethically valuable, but, you know, as you were saying, the self is shifts depending on, you know, where, what context you're coming from culturally. Mm-hmm. So that sense of self as fluid, and Suzuki Roshi sort of talking about that too, it's an interesting, gives us an interesting perspective on our usual idea of some fixed self.
Right. Right. I mean, I think the place it feels really clear to me is when you see people, you know, like people who have risked everything to come here. So they're immigrants and they're, you know, their goal is just to survive and then to get their family here. And so there's such a survival that is their identity. And then if they stabilize and they have enough money and the kids are in school and they're okay, you know, it's like it allows a different perspective and an ability to make choices more than they've had the option to, which is true for anybody who's been in limited striving circumstances.
Other comments? Bill?
And maybe it seems like the interest in historical fiction is a window of exploring maybe a little bit of what Ed was talking about with how much of the sort of innate wisdom of experience can I see reflected in other people through time in different contexts. That, like, something that like I that like what about my experience that I can only that can't be taught to me, but is only sort of experience. Can I see mirrored in many different contexts through time as a way of being able to help gain some of that ethical bearing? That's a question that interests me too. Like how much of the idea of the self stays constant through different contexts, and what elements of change depending on those contexts, and why is that, and how does it change into other things afterward, or is anything of that constant? Is it always changing? You know? But I think the investigation of historical literature or novels is a great window of analyzing that through time. You know?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I like the way you described it. Because sometimes you do identify, you know, as you read and you try to connect it to, like, sometimes, you know, when I was reading that novel, I was thinking, okay, that was a precursor to my parents. So I was trying to think, okay, I can see how that era and that way of thinking influenced the way my parents thought, even though they were not from elite New York City. But from that era in time. And so it, but also the individuals in the story, you can imagine in those circumstances how you also might be limited and wondering how you might react to it. What's universal and what's
particular.
Yeah.
Could you read that quote from Suzuki Roshi about seeing the person who seems to be practicing well? And
the person who seems to be practicing well. Wait. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I like this whole section. When you see someone practicing sincerely, you see yourself. If you're impressed by someone's practice, you may say, oh, she is doing very well. That she is neither she nor you. She is something more than that. What is she? After thinking for a while, you may say, oh, she is there and I am here. But when you are struck by her practice, that her is neither you nor her. When you are struck by something, that is actually the real you. Tentatively, I say you, but that you is the pure experience of our practice. As long as you are trying to improve yourself, you have a core idea of self, which is wrong practice. That is not the practice we mean. When you empty your mind, when you give up everything and just practice zazen with an open mind, then whatever you see, you meet yourself. That is you beyond she or he or me. As long as you are clinging to the idea of self and trying to improve your practice and or discover something, trying to create an improved, better self, then your practice has gone astray. You have no time to reach the goal. So eventually you will get tired and you will say, Zen is no good. I practiced Zazen for 10 years, but I didn't gain anything. But if you just come here and sit with sincere students and find yourself among them and you continue in that way, that is our practice. You can have this kind of experience wherever you are. As Tozen said, wherever I go, I meet myself.
It's a non-comparative self, where it's just appreciating whatever appears.
But it also implies trusting your instinct. If you see someone and say that's a good practice, trusting that you have an accurate observation or that you're sensing something, that you're picking up on something.
But it's not comparative. So it's like if you see some, if in a historical novel, if you appreciate something, it's not that you're comparing it to, you know, how things are now and how things were then and how things were some third time. It's just like, oh, that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting.
He's a pithy guy. I would like to have met him.
Me too. And yet we can't help but meet him. Any other comments? Thank you for the discussion.